behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Scott.
And I'm Ben, and we are joined, as always, by our super producer, Noel the Corsair Brown.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah.
Right? I really like that one.
I worked on that one earlier. Yeah.
Nice work.
So today, Scott, we're talking about an idea that you proposed that I thought was really interesting and brings us into these various what-if scenarios.
Yeah, and I can't take full credit for this. One of our coworkers,
mm-hmm.
His name is Dylan, and
yep.
Dylan is a photo editor here at How Stuff Works.
Yep, and he's quite a talented photographer in his own right.
Oh, very much so. And Dylan and I were talking one day over the very short cubicle walls that we have. And he said, hey, I just came across this Tumblr site, and it's called The Cars That Never Made It. And it's fascinating. It's got a lot of really interesting vehicles. You might, take a look at this for your Facebook posts and things like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I said, this is perfect. You know, as a matter of fact, what if Ben and I were to go through this Tumblr page? And it's a huge Tumblr page. There's a seemingly endless number of entries here.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just loaded with cars, like, prototypes and concept cars and a few homologation cars, for racing series.
Yeah.
And it's just loaded with vehicles that are very obscure and interesting. And I thought that, if we were to go through that and then pick out a few that we found interesting personally and talk about them in just a little bit more in depth than what, that Tumblr page does, because it only has, a quarter of a paragraph, like two or three sentences
mm-hmm.
about that vehicle. But if we were to kind of dig into them just a little bit further and get some real information about them, that would be something that would be interesting. And to combine with this, we can try to, along the way, we can maybe post a few of these on our Facebook page. So you can see these as well, or you can look them up on Google or whatever. Just a simple keyword search will do.
Mm-hmm.
I have been, over the past couple of weeks, prior to recording this, I've been taking a few of these and posting them on Facebook. So some are going to be in the on our Facebook archive, I guess.
Right.
If you scroll down the page a bit, you'll find a few of these. Others that we cover today, I'll try to make an effort to get them on there at some point, more or less. We can also post a link to the Cars That Never Made It site. I think
also,
that'd be interesting.
Also, let me just interrupt for a second.
Sure.
If you want to check out our Facebook page, go to Car Stuff HSW. We sure would appreciate it because, no guilt trip, but every like that you throw, it gets us a little closer to our dream cars and not being fired.
Yeah, it gets us a pat on the back,
Like pat on the back.
Like a nice job, guys, at the Monday meeting.
It's a little tip in the tip jar, but it doesn't cost a thing.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
I like that.
Thank you.
So like us there. We never really ask for that, do we?
No. I feel like sometimes it can be annoying. We'll mention it at the end of the show, but
yeah.
I'm sure that a lot of people who are on the internet are constantly receiving things where people say, like us on Facebook. And it's weird because this is a little bit of a tangent, Scott, but it's weird because all these places feel like they have to have these internet outlets. And ladies and gentlemen, you know what I'm talking about when you see something and it's like, Nathan's hot dogs or whatever, which are delicious. But then it's like, follow us on Instagram. So do I need, like, they're going to be pictures of hot dogs, right?
Yeah, possibly. Yeah. And I think around the 4th of July, you're going to get some kind of gross pictures maybe from their eating contest.
Oh yeah. Which we're both big fans of.
Yeah, we are. Actually, we're fans of that. As a matter of fact, we love competitive eating rather.
Yeah. I don't know why. I don't think I could do it, but it seems like such an interesting thing.
I like to kind of like make an amateur attempt at competitive eating sometimes.
I'll do it with some things. I've gotten into some weird places with pizza.
I once raced a dog eating an ice cream cone.
What?
And yeah. I drive. Well, okay. Here's the
different deal. Ice cream cones.
Yeah, not the same ice cream cone. No, I said I raced a dog. So years and years ago, this was like 25, 26 years ago, something like that. I was in high school,
mm-hmm.
eating an ice cream at a local place there, and it was in Birmingham, Michigan, and side of the road. Some owners had graciously given their dog an ice cream cone, which they sometimes do. They'll buy an ice cream, they'll just drop it right on the ground for the dog. I started my ice cream cone at the exact same time the dog did, and the dog was eating pretty fast. I thought, I could beat that dog. And I went for it. I totally went for it, brain freeze and all. I don't remember the outcome, if I won or not, because I probably passed out at some point. It felt like it anyways. It was it was a bad situation. I mean, you can't eat an ice cream cone as fast as a dog. It's just not humanly possible.
You can't eat an ice cream. Okay.
It was a small dog, too.
Let's take it to the listeners. Is it possible to eat ice cream faster than a dog? Because I think that's a fascinating question. But going back through the tree of our conversation here, we get it that a lot of places have, you know, like Facebook or Twitter and Instagram or Snapchat or whatever people are using. We just have the Facebook and the Twitter, and that's mainly to put stories on that may not make it to air. So if you like cars, it's worth your time, and it's free.
Wait, where do we go with this already? We just started the show.
Yeah.
We're talking about eating ice cream faster than dogs.
Which apparently
is
impossible.
Liking us on Facebook.
Yeah.
Where should we go with this?
Let's just go right to where we would have began the show if we weren't just kicking stuff around here.
Okay. All right. So we're talking about some of these prototype and concept cars and homologation cars and all that.
Yeah.
And I want to point out that some of these cars, and fantastic as they are, because, you know, hopefully you'll have an appreciation for these vehicles like we do.
Yes.
Sometimes, and actually quite often, manufacturers will build a prototype car, rather, never really intending to produce that car. They just bring it strictly for an auto show. Like, think about the General Motors Motorama cars.
Right.
Features of that car end up on production cars, but not the entire vehicle. The entire vehicle doesn't go necessarily into production always.
Right. Instead, they're a platform for the technology. They're a demo. They're a proof of concept.
A rolling test bed sometimes.
Sure.
Yeah.
At best, honestly.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, other times, you know, they do build these with hopes in getting the audience reaction. You know, they take it to the Geneva Motor Show, or they take it to the Detroit Auto Show, and they see how people react to it. You know, is it something we want to keep around? Other times, you know, it may not even, you know, on the auto show circuit, it may be removed after a few stops. You know, like it'll go to Detroit, it'll go to Chicago, but it won't make it to New York.
And this is a practice that has gone on for a very long time. Just for instance, just a quick example, the 1938 Buick Y-Job.
Ah, yes, the very first concept vehicle.
Right, right, which we talked about in some previous stuff.
Yeah, Harley Earl, right?
Yep. The first concept car that actually made it into production was the Osceola, right, with Henry Leland. But this car that was a true concept car because it was never meant to be in production. But it had a lot of things that would later end up being in production cars, right? Especially the styling. The 1938 Y-Job has that smooth styling with the you know, with like the chrome accents and stuff.
Way ahead of its time.
Way ahead.
And that's the thing, is all these are way ahead of their time. So, you know, the whole thing, you know, when you look at it, you may look at a concept vehicle and say, like, well, that looks kind of ridiculous. There's no way they're going to build a vehicle that looks like that. Maybe that was never the intent. It's just simply someone's fantastic dream, I guess, you know, a design study of some kind.
Right.
You know, those features or those elements of that vehicle will make it onto future production cars. And that's really oftentimes the only hope for it. You know, the general shape of the vehicle becomes the general shape of the next generation of that vehicle or even a different product line. I mean, maybe some stuff that comes from, you know, the Camaro, you know, concept vehicles, you know, ends up on the Corvette, you know, 5 years from now or, you know, something like that.
It's the gist. Or now I guess people would say the DNA.
Yeah, I guess that's a good way to put it. So where do you want to start, Ben? We got a list of them. We each chose a few of our favorites, I think. And again, it's a big, long list. So do you want me to kick things off here?
Yeah, kick things off.
All right. Here's one that I found really interesting. This is the Corvette four-rotor from 1973. And you heard right. It's a rotary engine in a Corvette. And there's actually a whole program, a rotary program, that was part of GM's focus at the time, you know, in the early 1970s, they were thinking that these Wankel engine, you know, these rotary engines, the four rotor engine that's used in this Corvette in particular was going to go into production with other GM products. And eventually that was canceled. It was not really given much due, I guess. But in 1973, they had a concept vehicle that was called the Corvette four rotor, and it was a 420 horsepower mid-engine Corvette. Now, a lot of people are clamoring for a mid-engine Corvette today.
Right.
They want kind of that supercar feel in the new Corvette, the brand new Corvette. And there's, you know, some talk of whether or not that's going to happen. There's some back and forth, you know, with GM. And I think a lot of people do think it's going to happen. But back in 1973, they actually built one. They built a concept vehicle. And, again, you know, this never really gained much traction because in the 1970s, like the early 1970s with the fuel crisis going on,
right.
GM decided that the rotary engine idea was going to be dropped altogether. Now, they didn't lose out completely with this vehicle because what they did was they took the engine out of that vehicle. They took the rotary engine out and, gave it a different engine, which I'll tell you about in a second, but GM didn't completely lose out on the four rotor Corvette design. Because they use that body again in a brand new vehicle. Now I know it's funny to say, but what they do is they just really removed the rotary engine from the four rotor Corvette.
Yeah,
and they created something that they called the Aerovette.
Yeah, 1976, right?
Yes. Yeah, and so instead of having that rotary engine, it had a 6.6 liter Chevy V8. You know, that was it was like a 400 cubic inch engine. But eventually, this car was this is amazing, Ben. This car was actually approved for production in 1980, but the decision was reversed. So as early as 1980, it was possible that they were going to build a mid-engine Corvette, but they for whatever reason, decided to pull back on that idea.
Waiting's the hardest part.
Yeah, right? I guess so. And, you know, one other Corvette that I want to mention just before we move on.
Yeah.
And it actually happens, you know, 1 year prior. I know that the two were kind of linked together, the rotary Vette and the Aerovette, but somewhere in the middle there in 1975, they were doing some kind of unusual one-off designs with you know, outside manufacturers. So there's something called the Greenwood Corvette Sportwagon. I bet a lot of people have maybe even seen an example of this, either in a museum or wherever, but there were quite a few of these made. It was a long roof Corvette from a previous generation, and the Greenwood car was considered a one-off, but a lot of these were made, and you know, these sport wagons were made, and they were made by a company called the American Custom Industries, or ACI.
Right.
And I know that I've seen these, I've seen one of these on the road, as a matter of fact. It must have been 25 years ago.
Yeah, I was going to say it wasn't here.
No, it was like late 1980s in the Detroit area.
Oh, okay.
I know somebody had one. I've seen a brown one. It was brown, of all things. A brown Corvette that's a station wagon as well. So, but I know I've seen one, and in museums, I feel like I've passed by one before, but didn't really give it all that much of a look because, I don't know. It's just not something that I'm really all that interested in. It has kind of that bread van style, I guess, you know, like the Ferrari bread van.
Yeah.
But it's a Corvette wagon, kind of interesting, kind of not. I don't know.
It's interesting, but my question would be, does it make sense?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, sort of. I mean, it's one of those things where you're giving up, you know, having a four-seat vehicle and all that space to have a two-seat vehicle that's a toy.
Right.
This one has a little bit more functionality, I suppose. You can carry a little bit more in it, not a whole lot more, really, when you look at the size of the wagon. It's not like they extended the wheelbase and made it a huge, huge wagon.
No.
They just changed the back end of it a bit.
That's it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we should also mention that many cars that never made it fall because of some accident or tragedy in history, right?
Sure. Yeah.
An oil crisis, a world war, something like that. Some cars, however, were doomed never to make it from the start. And I say that simply as an objective statement, because now I'd like to submit for your consideration, ladies and gentlemen, the BMW Gina Light Visionary model.
Oh, yeah. Well, this one we've seen in person.
You and I were lucky enough to see this one in person. This BMW is a concept car that says, you know what cars have too much of? Metal. So let's make the car's skin, instead of using fiberglass or metal or some kind of even carbon fiber composite, they use fabric with a carbon fiber kind of skeleton beneath it. So this vehicle, it moves the way that your pants move when you bend your leg. Like when the door is open, you can see the wrinkles in the fabric, right? The hood opens vertically along a seam running down the center of the hood. This vehicle looks so cool. It looks so cool. It is completely impractical.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Yeah. And they try to tell you all the reasons why it is practical, of course, you know, that it repels water and that, you know, it can change for the driving conditions. You know, it can have a spoiler if you want it to have a spoiler just by simply activating a switch that raises up another piece of that internal skeleton that creates a spoiler at the back end, you know, where it could drop it off. You know, for lower speeds.
Right.
All kinds of things like that. Like the openings for the headlights, I think. Don't the headlights open up as well?
Yeah, they open and close like blinking. And even in the, even once you get to the instruments and the dash, that blinking fabric thing closes the closes the instruments that you don't need to see.
Oh, I don't like that at all.
Yeah, I want to see everything that's happening.
Yeah, I don't like the closing gauges idea.
Right.
But it is it's an interesting idea, sure, and it's a great design study, and it's fascinating to watch this thing, you know, do whatever it does. You know, the engine opening up, it's fascinating to watch the doors open.
The car itself, we should say, looks kind of like a Z4 Roadster.
Yeah, it sure does. Yeah, it's a very shiny, it has a shiny surface, but again, it's cloth, and how practical is that really? I mean, I don't know. I'm not a huge fan of it, but it's a cool look at. And to see it in person is a lot different than seeing a short YouTube clip of it doing its thing as well.
Right.
It was impressive, really. I mean, when you see it, it's like, well, I could kind of see this as being a niche car for them. You know, someone that has an interest in having something that's completely unusual, something that you can take to the local car shows and maybe win occasionally with.
If the weather's okay.
Yeah. If the weather's okay,
it's
just
right. It's like, again, it's a proof of concept, but it is a car that never made it, even if it wasn't intended to ever make it, which clearly it wasn't. It's a car that I would think would be astonishing if there were something like that on the road.
Yeah, yeah, it really would be. I don't think it could ever hold up to the crash tests that it required.
Something tells me unless all cars are made out of fabric, no cars will be made out of
yeah,
fabric.
That's probably right. That's a good way to look at it. All right, so the next one, Ben, that I had was the Moeller M200X, and this is from 1997, and you're going to already know why I don't like this one. It's a flying car.
Oh, but you picked – I thought we were picking cars we like.
Picking unusual cars.
And I got so excited when I thought, whoa, Scott, you've buried the hatchet.
Oh, no. There's a few here that are not so great. Some real bricks. But
you know, this is one of them.
Yeah, this is one of them. This is a crazy car. Now, it's almost exactly like the Jetsons car, only this one only seats two, not four. And that's the big difference, I guess. It really does look like the Jetsons car with the bubble top and everything.
Right. It's a like a 1950s retro futuristic UFO circular design.
Yeah, flying saucer.
Eight, but instead of some sort of magic anti-gravity technology, it has what, eight fans?
It has eight electric fans that power this thing, and it really does fly. This
one does hover.
This one does work. And they flew it to, and I'll say, okay, it hovered, to about 50 feet back in, 1989. They took it up to that, height. So it's been around for a while. This company, as I found out today, still exists. You can go to Moeller.com and look it up. You can learn all about the engines. You can invest in the company or whatever you want to do.
That's cool.
Now they have four vehicles. It's not just this one. Now this one, this type of vehicle is called the New Era 200. And they also have another type that's called the Aerobot, which is an unmanned vehicle that can hold a payload of 5 to 650 pounds. It's a huge range, but
that's cool.
Yeah, an Aerobot. So they consider that more like a drone almost, but that can carry something. Also, they have, there's a model 200 and model 400 Sky Car. Now, that's a two-passenger vehicle. It looks more like a plane, a jet.
Yeah, and that's the one that they've been getting a lot of attention about as well.
Yeah, I guess. Now, that's there's something funny about that one.
It looks much more like a plane.
If I recall correctly, isn't that the one when they did the test, they had to have it tethered with a crane, and a lot of people accuse them of just simply lifting it with a crane?
Oh, I thought that was the 200X.
Oh, I don't know. I don't think that was it. I thought that was the Sky Car, but we'll have to look into that and see which one it was.
Okay.
And they also have another vehicle there that was called the Firefly. Now, the Firefly is a lot like the New Era 200, which was formerly called the M200X.
Yeah.
But the Firefly seats four. So that was one of the problems. You know, they said, well, it only seats two people, and this one seats four. It's kind of like a recreational vehicle, if you want to call it that. You know, it's capable of X miles per hour. I think the cruising speed is like 75 miles per hour. And this is all, hypothetical at this point.
Right.
I don't think I've seen any of these fly. Well, I know I haven't seen any fly. I haven't been able to find any footage of them actually flying. But you can go to the website and read all about the car. So,
right.
But I don't know.
I'm glad that you mentioned the stuff about the crane, because maybe it was both the Sky Car and the crane for the 200X, because I distinctly remember seeing a photo of the thing and seeing a crane, and as a child thinking, that's obviously fake.
Yeah.
And then my folks said, they probably have to have it there for safety purposes.
I think that was the whole thing. And the company said, no, it had to be there. It had to be tethered for exactly the reason you said. But then you get a lot of photographs that show it as if it's flying, and then you get the reverse angle that shows the crane that's suspending it. Now, I don't know, how much tension was on that line or whatever, but It's an interesting little bit of history anyways, you know, well, flying cars.
Now, well, let's also say one other thing, though, that's really cool.
Okay.
These things, when we say flying, they're flying in that they're in the air, but they're not flying the way a Jetsons car would. They don't go near as high mm-hmm. as a Jetsons flying car, and they depend on ground effect, right? The same thing that a Chronoplan uses.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah, that was interesting to learn about those, right? Those huge, huge Soviet, well, I guess they'd be low flying planes, really.
Yeah, but ground effect vehicles.
Yeah, ground effect vehicle, I guess is the way to say it. So, and we've got an episode on that if you want to go back to it. And, and by the way, you know, if you want to read a little bit more about the Moeller, vehicles, you know, the M200X, How Stuff Works does have an article, at least a page in an article, because we have a whole big article about flying vehicles. And Moeller occupies at least one page, and I think the Sky Car might be in there as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go ahead and move on to something else that I thought was pretty interesting. Let's see, Scott. I've got one that I want to save till the end.
Okay,
if that's all right. So instead of doing that one, let's talk about the Nissan Pevo 2.
Pevo 2. Okay.
The Pevo 2.
How do you spell Pevo?
P-I-V-O.
P-I-V-O, okay.
So the Pevo 2 is a it's very tiny, like smart car kind of concept,
like,
right?
Like a city car.
Right. Yeah, it's exactly right. Like a little QB looking city car, and it has four small electric motors on each wheel.
Okay.
So this means each wheel can move independently, turning sideways if you have trouble parallel parking, sliding closer to a car while turning, and it has a robot co-pilot, so it has a robotic assistant.
Come on. Really?
Yeah. It monitors your mood while driving, and it'll try to cheer you up.
Oh.
And also does, like, other supervisory things, you know, like proximity warning, I think, and other like housekeeping things that we see some electric vehicles doing now.
Wait, this is maybe I'm confused. This is the co-pilot robot that's doing this stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't like this at all. I don't like this at all. I can tell you right now.
To Odyssey 2001.
No, I just don't like it. Yeah. Yeah.
So this is, going to be a concept for a long time. The most interesting thing I think is the independent movement of the wheels. However, the thing that means this is going to stay a concept no matter what the design is going to be the price tag. Having all this neat, non-proven stuff in one vehicle is just not going to work. Also, the whole front opens.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
No, like, side door.
Yeah, there's a few cars that have done that in the past. But, the idea that they're going to cram everything onto this vehicle, all into one vehicle, it makes it very, very expensive. Whereas if they take... I'm looking at a picture of it now.
You see that creepy little robot head at the front?
That's awful. That's awful. All right. So yeah, the idea that they're going to put everything into one vehicle and make it super, super expensive. That's what we're talking about, is that they might take, you know, three parts of that and put it onto a production vehicle.
Yeah.
And it becomes, you know, part of a bigger system, you know, that all works together. I like that idea. So the Nissan Pevo,
I did Pevo 2 mm-hmm. just because I thought it was the funkiest looking.
Yeah.
But there are two other Pevos. The original Pevo, which has a side open door, and then the Pevo 3, which premiered at the 2011 Tokyo Motor Show.
Oh, so this is pretty recent then.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you know what? Let's just close by saying the Nissan Pevo, don't look for it in a showroom anytime soon.
No, right.
How about that?
But it also has a, it can be, the Pevo 3 can be remotely maneuvered by a smartphone, Scott.
Oh my gosh.
How convenient.
This gets worse and worse.
What could go wrong?
This is a terrible idea for Nissan. All right. All right, Ben, let's move on to the next pick here on my list. And it's a very unusual one, and one that probably not many listeners have really ever heard of. It's called the Bee. And the mm-hmm. Bee, what year was this? Around 1959. So we're the late 1950s, and it was designed by Curtis Wright. And Curtis Wright, as you'll know, is an aerospace company.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like kind of the best way to describe it maybe is it's a civilian version of the hovercraft. And so here's the problem with this whole design. And for one, the car looks like a brick. It looks like it's an odd shape. It's a great big rectangle, very boxy. I mean, it looks cool looking back at it now, but at the time, think about the cars that were around in 1959. That would not really be all that appealing to somebody.
No. Yeah.
It wouldn't have that much appeal. I mean, it's interesting, but only looking back with, you know, kind of a romanticized version of what 1950s
right.
and, you know, that whole retro future thing.
Well, here's the problem.
Yeah.
We should go ahead and say that it did work.
Oh, yeah, that's the thing. This actually did hover. And
this
looking at
did
that,
hover.
I don't know how this thing hovered. I mean, when
it
you look at it,
heavy as, it looks heavy as hell, honestly.
It really does. It's 21 feet long, and it only seats two people.
Right.
Again, it's very, very square. It has all, you know, everything that you'd expect. It has front bumper. It has headlights, you know, quad headlights. It's convertible, has a raked windshield on top. But aside from that, this thing is a great big rectangular box. It's a very unusual looking car. There are photos of it actually hovering. It really does work, and the military was interested in this, as you can imagine. The military bought two vehicles for engineering and operational evaluation in 1960, but the hover car couldn't deal with the rough terrain that they asked it to deal with, so they dropped the idea completely within 1 year. So the military bought it, but they didn't necessarily like it. Now, this car, this two-seater car that we're looking at, had a top speed of 56 miles per hour, which is pretty good, and that's from a 100-horsepower single engine. Later, they were planning to come out with a four-seater version that had two engines and 300 horsepower.
Right.
Again, a four-seater that they never got around to building. But you can find some old photographs of the B, and you know the idea that it truly worked—that's pretty fascinating to me. I mean, it doesn't look like it should fly.
Right.
And I don't know if fly is not the right way to say it, but it doesn't look like it should hover.
Well, it looks like somebody cut the sides off of a regular car and cut the sides and the bottom off a regular car. That's what it looks like.
Yeah, you think so? Yeah, like to square it off almost like you'd square off a piece of cake or something.
Exactly. I'm thinking about a slice of cake. Yeah, here's the other thing, though. It just wasn't practical.
No.
Like you would be paying for something that looked like you were getting less car for your money, more moving parts, which makes it more difficult to maintain, and it can't go the places that a normal sedan can go.
Well, they knew the problems with this vehicle too, because I mean, when you look at it, it's comically large. There's a picture of a guy sitting in this vehicle with his arm out the window, you know, trying to look cool, I guess, in the floating car. But the idea was that the mechanics of the car at the time, remember 1959, they couldn't be scaled down enough. The components weren't small enough to make something that was stylish as well. So they were kind of dealt this situation, you know, like we've got the technology to make it work. We just can't make it look good for a civilian vehicle. It might be great for military application, but, and not specifically this, but the way that we have to design this car, it's not going to look good for anybody to, you know, pick it up in the dealer showroom.
You know, that's a pretty good point, because it's not so much of this is dependability, but also so much of it is just aesthetic.
Yeah, that's true. And there's more to it than that. I mean, I know that I'm sure that it probably would fail any kind of braking exercise. You know, how do you brake a hovercraft all that effectively? You know, when you're in a traffic situation, a stop and go situation. I think hills play a big part of this as well.
Right.
The grade of hills. If you're traveling through the mountains, trying to ride in a hovercraft, I don't know how well that's going to work. I feel like we've talked about it in the past.
We have, yeah, I think we have.
It's kind of too bad that this never came through for them, for Curtis Wright, because it's a neat idea. And it looks interesting, but again, it's just I can see why no one really bought it at the time.
All right, so I'm going to skip over one vehicle because we've talked about it at length and we've seen designs for it, and you've seen the videos we posted about it in the recent past, listeners. If you check us out on Facebook and Twitter. That's the Demaxion. Can we just skip the Demaxion?
Oh, very good. You know what? We can skip it. And can I mention one little thing though?
Sure.
I was recently at the Lane Auto Museum in Tennessee.
Yeah.
And I saw a replica of the Demaxion.
Did you get to drive it? Obviously not, because you're still alive.
No. I didn't get to drive it, but it was a highlight of my visit. It was really cool. It was on the floor, and it's an exact replica that they built
to scale.
Yes, to scale. It's like a full scale. You know, full on Dymaxion right there on the floor.
Drivable?
Yes.
What?
Yeah. I, you know what? Yes. I didn't see it driving personally. I didn't witness this, but I know that the Lane Museum makes a habit of driving their vehicles. I think it's twice a year every vehicle gets
That's good.
Exercised, stretched.
I'm just so fascinated with the Demaxian, but so disappointed in its performance.
Yes, yes. I think everybody is. And even the founder, really. No, he had nothing but good things to say about it.
He thought it was great.
Yeah. Well, that's true.
Buckminster Fuller thought that car was the wave of the future.
Well, yeah. I mean, interesting design. I agree. I like to look at it, but I would not like to ride it, I don't think.
So now that we've skipped, I would be okay with riding in it, you know, if I already knew, like, I had nowhere to be in a hurry. But speaking of unusual vehicles, I've got one here that I thought would be interesting, and maybe some of our listeners have heard of it. Do you remember the Volkswagen GX3?
No, I don't.
Concept car, three-wheeler, and it's here.
I'm looking at it now.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So a bit of a slingshot looking vehicle.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Slingshots have been on my mind, man. I think it's because there's so many more in Atlanta now. But this was kind of like the hybrid between a motorcycle and a race car, right? And it had a 1.6 liter four cylinder engine, but was still able to get to 60 miles per hour in 5.7 seconds.
Now you're using past tense here. I noticed.
So yes.
Is this one that is not in production? I haven't followed all of the three-wheel vehicles out there. I really like them, but there's so many that are coming out now that I'm having trouble remembering who's actually producing one, who's not producing one.
So this is Volkswagen.
And yeah,
it's
Volkswagen.
Interesting you say that, Scott, because you could have almost had a GX3.
Almost.
It had a shipping date of, are you ready?
Yeah.
Early 2007 for a little while, because it's a pretty recent car, but just before it went to the factories and in production, Volkswagen said, okay, it might have some safety issues.
Oh boy. Okay. So this is, well, that's a long time ago and we have not seen any. So apparently, it didn't really make it to production.
Well,
I'm sure there's some one-offs here and there, right?
Right. They're similar designs, clearly. Like you said, reminds you of a slingshot.
Sure.
One of their designs was that it was so small and so low to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
I recall,
because that was right around the time when I started here at How Stuff Works, and I remember looking at that vehicle thinking, like, oh, this is going to be pretty cool. If, you know, things like this are starting to come out, we're going to have a lot to talk about. I guess we never got around to that one, that VW three-wheeler.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, well.
All right. Well, here's one that I know that I posted on Facebook recently, but still warrants a mention here because there's a little bit more to talk about. This was built by a company in 1967. It's called the Silver Fox, and it was built by a company called OSI. And OSI is a coach building company. It was founded in Turin, Italy in 1960. And the founder, unfortunately, died not long after that, 1963.
Mm-hmm.
But the company, didn't have, you know, once he died, his personal link or the personal link from the company to some of these bigger manufacturers, like Ghia and Ford kind of dissolved because it was the owner of the company that had this personal relationship. It wasn't like a contract was set up or anything like that.
Right.
So, they kind of floundered a little bit after the founder died. And then OSI went on, you know, to continue to exist for about another 5 years. They kind of languished a bit for about 5 years, and then eventually they were absorbed into Fiat's design office. Or I don't know if absorbed is the right way to say it, but sort of like that, into Fiat in about 1968. So OSI hasn't been around since then. But they designed this vehicle called the Silver Fox, and this is the one that was the twin hull design. So the passengers sit on two completely separate sides of the vehicle. It looks like it's split in two almost.
Yeah.
Think about it like a catamaran design, except with wheels. And that's what this vehicle is. It had a very small engine. It had a 1 liter Renault Alpine engine, which was good for a 155 mile per hour top speed. That's amazing because it's such a small car, such a small engine. I understand,
right,
you know, that works together, but this car had a lot of aerodynamic, unique aerodynamic aids that went along with it. It had
three spoilers, right?
Yes, it did. It had a front spoiler, which was manually adjustable when the vehicle was stationary. You couldn't do that while it was moving. Had a middle spoiler, which could be adjusted while it was moving. And then it had a rear spoiler, which was permanently fixed. So these aerodynamic aids, along with this lightweight design, this really unique design, helped it to achieve that 155 miles per hour. And They were hoping that they were going to be able to take this vehicle to Le Mans, but the company folded just a little bit before they realized that dream, and they never quite made it. So this is kind of one of those one of those unique one-off vehicles that's out there still, but never really made it to the big show like it wanted to.
Yeah, it got orphaned.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And speaking of orphaned cars and other unfortunate auto-related events, Scott, my friend, the Walter White to my Jesse Pinkman, it appears that we have let time get away with us, and we might have to make this a two-part episode.
Oh, I'm all for that, because there's an unlimited supply of cars here.
I know. Neither of us have really got through our notes. I felt like we were just starting to get going, in fact.
It was that whole intro conversation that went way off into somewhere we didn't expect.
Yeah, I guess we learned our lesson.
Not really.
We should start with another tangent on the next episode. But before we do, I want to say, right now, my most favorite car that never made it is something that, Scott, you already know what I'm going to say.
Oh, I don't know if I do.
The 1938 Phantom Corsair. Dude.
Oh, okay. Well, that ties right in with Noel's nickname for today.
Exactly.
Okay, got
exactly.
it. Oh, this is the one that was designed by the ketchup guy, right?
Rust Hines.
Yeah, the ketchup guy. I call him the ketchup
guy. He's the heir to the 57 varieties empire.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. What else are you going to do? Build a Phantom Corsair.
So he had this. They started with a Cord 810, removing the front wheel drive subframe and Lycoming V8 drivetrain, and mating it to an X-Brace chassis. They had kicked up rear frame rails. This car is just so ahead of its time. It has so many innovations that no one was dreaming of. One of the most famous ones that people remembered when we did a whole show on it.
Yeah.
So I don't want to rehash it too much. But we had a lot of people writing in about the unusual seating configuration.
Oh, I love that. I love the seating, how wide that front bench was.
And right, yeah.
Man, this car, man, that's a fantastic pick, because this car is so striking when you see it. It's amazing. It was used in movies.
Yeah.
It's just a beautiful, beautiful design. And as you said, way, way ahead of its time. There's so many elements to this car.
Mm-hmm.
Again, if you get a chance, listen to our episode on this car. We did a full episode on the Phantom Corsair.
Yeah.
And it's well worth your time. There's so much to it and the history of it. Just an interesting story all around, I think.
Man, and it's, okay, yeah, I'm probably going to go back and listen to that episode, because I love the Phantom Corsair. Look it up. It's probably the most flattering nickname I've given Noel. I've also had a lot of coffee. All right, but we're going to make this a two-parter. We're going to head out. We hope to hear from you in the interim. This is your chance to write to us and let us know cars that never made it, that you think either deserved a shot or were doomed from the start. Tell us about it on Facebook and Twitter. We're CarStuffHSW at both of those. Do your best to get your ideas in as soon as you hear this, because they might end up on our second episode. And if you'd like to email us directly, well, luckily for everyone involved, we have an email address.
Yes, we do, and it is carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.